President Biden is in Connecticut today as he pushes his billion-dollar infrastructure plan and focuses on his childcare initiatives. But what is he hoping to gain from this trip? Also, it's relatively rare in Massachusetts politics when a resident of the western part of the state mounts a campaign for statewide office. These are just some of the stories we'll discuss in our Friday roundtable this week on And Another Thing from New England Public Media. I'm Maya
Schwader. And I'm Derek Kennedy. Also coming up, why this part of Massachusetts stands to lose a seat on Beacon Hill. And legislators from around the state present new data showing an east-west rail would be far more popular than predicted. And will the U.S. Supreme Court reinstate the death penalty for the convicted Boston Marathon bomber? We'll discuss today. Let's meet our panel now for this week.
Elizabeth Roman is a reporter for The Republican and Mass Live. She's also an editor for El Pueblo Latino. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Tammy Daniels is the executive editor of iBerkshires.com. Welcome.
Well, good to be here.
And finally, hello to Dave Eisenstatter. He was the longtime features editor for the Hampshire Gazette. He's now the digital editor for the public radio station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Thanks for being here.
Welcome to you all. Let's begin with the president's visit to Connecticut today. It's his second trip to the state since taking office. Senator Richard Blumenthal gave his thoughts on why the Constitution State remains a favorable destination for the president.
More than just the physical assets, roads, bridges, rail, ports and airports, it's the people who will use them. And the president coming here will give us a boost as we go back to Washington to get the job done and push this program over the finish line.
So Dave, we'll start for you as you're in Connecticut. The president was there for commencement ceremonies in May. He endorsed Governor Ned Lamont in Hartford in 2018. Additionally, the vice president, the first lady, the secretary of education, the Commerce Secretary and the Labor Secretary have all made visits to Connecticut since Biden took office. Does what Senator Blumenthal said sound accurate as to why he keeps coming back?
Well, I think it's always exciting when a president comes to town. And I think maybe President Biden also feels a personal commitment to be at this specific dedication for his former Senate colleague in Hartford. But I think you do have to wonder about his tactics when there's so much on the line. There are two senators holding up his domestic agenda, and neither one is from Connecticut. It's nice to see Biden in Connecticut, but I hope he's also planning some more trips to Arizona, West Virginia, talking to people about expanded Medicare, universal pre-K, child tax credit expansion, all things that are really popular in blue states and red states and purple states.
And to that point, and this now goes to everyone else, Biden's visit is highlighting the impact of about $300 million in federal money for childcare programs since the pandemic began, but also that federal funding infrastructure bills, those are in front of Congress right now. So he's also pushing that agenda. Do the examples and benefits of Connecticut help push the need to pass these bipartisan bills to the panel?
I've got to echo what Dave said. I'm curious as to why he's picking Connecticut. You have, like he noted, you have two senators who are really holding this up in West Virginia and Arizona. And we all know West Virginia in particular is in the bottom for a lot of in education, in health and infrastructure. So I guess I don't quite understand why Connecticut would be his choice to go to when he could be in West Virginia saying, you need bridges, you need roads, you need hospitals.
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do, like Dave said, he has a friend there, he has a connection, he wanted to support him in that way. He generally has support in this part of the country, so why not continue that goodwill with people that already support your ideas? I think the fact that he's in Hartford specifically highlighting childcare is important because it's something that with the pandemic has come to the forefront. The fact that people don't have safe or affordable childcare or universal pre-K to leave their children in this location while they go and work. In Massachusetts, there's so many families, and in Connecticut as well, Hartford, very similar to Springfield, single family, households, moms working that can't stay home and take care of their kids. They don't have that option. So yeah, I think there's a lot of goodwill for him in this part of the country. And I think, being able to visit his friend, he's human too. He probably just wanted to be there to celebrate with him. Maybe not the best idea at this time when the pressure's on, but yeah, I think maybe that's why.
And speaking of infrastructure, In Massachusetts, the much ballyhooed East-West Rail is back in the news. There is a new study out that concludes ridership would actually be more than 50% higher than previously predicted, in part because the new analysis includes the Hartford region. Hartford Mayor Luke Bronin says he doesn't understand why this previous research ignored the population there.
It's as crazy to estimate rail usage on East and West line without Hartford as it would be to estimate air travel from Bradley without Springfield.
Elizabeth, this rail plan, the East-West Rail, has been discussed for so many years. Do we feel like it's any closer to reality now?
Honestly, bringing in the Hartford element, I think, could make a really big difference. I am a Springfield lifelong resident, and I go to Hartford way more than I ever go to Boston because it's just closer to me. It's right across the border. I have friends there. There's tons of places to eat and hang out, and it's right near home. It's like 25 minutes from me. So incorporating this aspect, if you have a Hartford to Springfield to Boston connection, I think it could bring in federal funding, and I think that it could become a much more attractive possibility. Of course, they've been talking about this my entire career at the newspaper. Senator Lesser, I know, has gone really hard for this for quite some time. Congressman Neal as well. But this might be a game changer for them.
For the panel, why do we think this has been such a hard sell? What has been the holdup here?
I mean, I think that Western Massachusetts, I think a rail plan is expensive. Getting East-West Rail has been a priority for Western Mass forever. I don't think it's been the same level of priority in Boston, and I think that's why it's taken so long. But yeah, a study like this is huge, and I'm so glad that the mayor brought up that comparison to Bradley. Hartford and Springfield already share, you know, essentially the same air travel passengers. It makes sense to include Hartford and Connecticut in this East-West Rail study. And I really hope that does push it over the top.
Part of the difficulty for getting attention for projects in this part of the state is the population is declining as it increases in other areas. And that's catching up with Western Mass in the process. Following the U.S. Census, each state has to set new legislative districts. And the proposal put out this week leaves Western Mass with one less state lawmaker. The four westernmost counties would have the same number of state lawmakers, but Franklin County would lose a seat in the Massachusetts House. Now, State Senator Adam Hines of Pittsfield is a member of the state's redistricting commission and says he's pleased that this area is not losing more representation.
We fought really hard as a Western Mass delegation to make sure that we didn't lose the total number of seats of senators. That wasn't easy because of the dynamic of losing population and on top of that having the greater Boston area adding people.
More on Senator Hines in a minute, but first, Tammy, considering the 2020 census results, doesn't he have a good point there?
Yeah, and most of my work has been in Berkshire County, which is going to lose a representative. We're going to go from four Berkshire seats to three. One of those seats was also part of Franklin. So we saw our population dip by less than 2%, while the rest of the state in the East went up by like 7.5%. And it really means that we have a huge amount of territory, largely rural, that is going to lose representation. And I think going back to the rail thing, this is one of the why Hines and others have been championing part of the rail system is to say that people could be able to live in Western Massachusetts and still be able to work on the eastern part of the state through rail. But it makes our voice much less. In 1979, we had six representatives, including one that was a Berkshire Franklin. And now we're down to three in Berkshire, and we're losing a Franklin seat. So it's definitely going to have an effect on us in the state house.
To the rest of the panel, there's a lot that happens legislatively in Western Massachusetts. Do you think they get ignored from state government?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any question. Suzanne Bump just released a report, I think earlier this week, saying that infrastructure projects in this part of the state are just not getting funded at the rate that they are in the rest of the state. I mean, it's a broken record situation with us. We always talk about it, and it doesn't get answered because we're further out, because people always, you know, nationally associate Massachusetts with Boston, with Cape Cod. They're not thinking about the little communities. You know, Hampden County, we've got Springfield, and for better or for worse, people know who we are. But when you start getting out to some of the smaller communities, you're just not hearing about them. You don't know where they are. You don't know who represents them. And losing this seat is catastrophic for us, to be honest.
I think just to take a step back to look at the whole process, I wonder, why is it that these legislators are the ones that are drawing the lines in the first place? It seems like we have in Massachusetts a typical case of the legislators choosing their voters instead of the other way around. You know, why don't we have an independent commission that makes these districts that make sense? The case of Greenfield is like a perfect example of, it's the anchor community in Franklin County and it's being split among two districts. Like how does that make sense when you look at this? When you do look at the proposed map and you look at it versus the previous map, you can see that a lot of these districts are drawn to protect incumbents. And you know, if that's the priority of the people drawing the lines, that's what we're gonna see. And the people who live in these districts are the ones who are gonna suffer.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Friday Roundtable on And Another Thing with Dara Kennedy. I'm Maya Schwader. Our panel today is iBerkshires.com executive editor Tammy Daniels, WSHU digital editor Dave Eisenstadter, and reporter and editor Elizabeth Roman from Mass Live, the Republican, and El Pueblo Latino.
Earlier, we heard a clip from Senator Adam Hines, who recently announced he's running for lieutenant governor. It's not exactly a surprise move, but it is somewhat rare for political figures from this part of Massachusetts.
I'll tell you what, right now it feels like we're not even getting the fundamentals right. You know, every day people come to me and say that they're having problems with housing affordability and childcare access and affordability. We're not confronting climate change with the aggressiveness that we need.
Hines does have a few Western Mass predecessors in statewide office. In 1998, Republican Jane Swift was elected lieutenant governor. She later became acting governor, and Democrat Tim Murray from Worcester was elected lieutenant governor in 2007. But there isn't a whole lot besides that. Panel, why do you think there aren't more statewide office holders from Western Massachusetts? Tammy, do you want to start?
Well, I think we've already talked about it. We don't have a lot of people out here. We don't have a lot of connections to the eastern part of the state. We do get looked over. We all have very small towns. If you call the eastern part of the state and you say, I'm calling from Florida, they think they're talking about the state of Florida, not the town of Florida. So that's one reason. I think it's just really hard for anybody out on this side to really get their name out. And I would note that there is not just Adam Hines running for statewide office, that Benjamin Downing, who was his predecessor in the state Senate for 10 years, is running for governor. So it might be exciting for people in Berkshire County, Western Mass, to be thinking that you could have, you know, two representatives from Western Mass, you know, being in the state house. But I honestly think it's a long shot. I think it's just hard for people out here to really get that kind of recognition.
I think he has his sights set on the right office, though. I don't think people from out here necessarily, unless they've made a really big name for themselves, have a shot at the governor's chair.
I would say I found it interesting that that Senator Adam Gomez came out and supported Hines, and I'll just say that based in Springfield, he has a good reputation in the community. Even though he's a new senator, his family has been involved in politics and in the community for a long time. And as a Latina myself, I do pay attention when a person of color endorses someone. I didn't know much about Hines before, but I'll give him a second look. I'll see a little bit more about him, what he stands for and what he believes. And I think that could draw some attention to him that he wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So endorsements like that, I think, are necessary and important. And I'm curious to see what happens with his race.
Still ahead, as we continue to review some news from around the area this week, the warm welcome for the growing number of Afghanistan evacuees arriving in our region. You're listening to And Another Thing from New England Public Media. This is And Another Thing. I'm Dara Kennedy with Maya Schrader. It's Friday, and it's our look and review with panelists from around the region. Welcome back in.
With us this week are Dave Eisenstadter, digital editor for the public radio station WSHU in Connecticut. Elizabeth Roman, she is the editor of El Pueblo Latino and a reporter for The Republican and Mass Live. And Tammy Daniels is the executive editor of iBerkshires.com.
Next, a topic that we've paid a good amount of attention to on the program this week, the growing number of evacuees arriving specifically in Western New England from Afghanistan. It's an overwhelming process for most of the families involved, but resettlement agencies report an outpouring of goodwill and offers of help. Shannon Hansen with the group Accentria says that particularly she appreciates the offers from fellow Afghans.
Whether it's helping provide interpretation or orienting them to the community, the neighborhood, helping find grocery stores where they might be able to find, you know, more traditional foods, things like that, that they really wanted to help step up and offer that help.
Elizabeth, I'll start with you. What type of reaction to evacuees are you seeing in the communities that you cover?
I mean, I think Springfield, Holyoke area, we're used to it. This is nothing new for us to have people from many parts of the world, particularly, I mean, in terms of Americans coming over, we had Hurricane Maria and many Puerto Ricans came this way. So, and that was very recent, just 2017, 2018. We've had people come from Nepal. We've had people come from all parts of the world. So I'm not surprised that there's an outpouring of support for them. I know Jewish Family Services in Springfield has said they created an Amazon wish list so people can go on there. And right now they're not accepting, you know, clothing or furniture, probably because of COVID, but there is a list of people want to, you know, donate in that way. And interestingly enough, they're also searching for people who speak Pashto, which is a smaller subset of the population, the dialect. There's a lot of people that can translate in Farsi, but not in that language. So if you're listening and you speak it, they are looking for people who can, you know, are willing to do that. And yeah, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, Springfield has always been a pretty welcoming place. We've certainly had our struggles, and there's certainly issues of housing that are coming up, and they've talked about that already. Affordable housing is very difficult to find. I don't see that clearing up for these new refugees, but, you know, we're happy to have them here. We are so interconnected with Afghanistan because we were there for 20 years, whether people want to admit to that or not, or face it or not, it's in our face now. And it's something that I think it's a responsibility of Americans to handle.
Tammy, I'd like to hear your point on this.
I have to agree with Elizabeth. I think, you know, she's talking about Springfield, but I think Berkshire County and some of the rural areas have been more than welcoming to immigrants in this area. We're trying to find out if some of those refugees will be settling up in the Northern Berkshire area and around Pittsfield. And I hope very much that they are welcomed here, because I agree, we were there for 20 years. I think we do have a responsibility to help these people who are helping us overseas for that long. And this has got to be an enormous disruption for them with language, with culture, with simply, you know, the change in climate I am very hopeful that we'll be more than welcoming to them when they get here.
You know, Dave, interesting, in addition to speaking about the Afghan evacuees, we've talked about, you know, 40, 50 years ago when the Vietnamese came over, and how right now the Haitians have this issue at the Mexico border, but they're also flowing into our communities. What's been the reaction from the stories that you've covered as to how the communities are welcoming all groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think that the whole panel is right, that there has been a history of resettling refugees and asylum seekers in this region, both in Massachusetts and Connecticut. There are big networks that have been built out over decades of time, and I think it's really great. This has been such an emotional piece of the Afghanistan withdrawal, of like what is going to happen to all these families of people who are, you know, desperately trying to get out, who had helped us for all those years. And I think it's great that we have so many people in the communities here that are, you know, willing to lend a hand to families that are truly in need, but also that have a lot to offer to us in this region in terms of cultural diversity for the area.
Our last topic for today, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments about whether to reinstate the death penalty in the case of Jahar Tsarnaev, the convicted terrorist in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. There are questions as to how strongly influenced he was by his older brother, who died in a police shootout and never went to trial. The justices had a lot of questions about that relationship. So these new revelations, the arguments that the defense is making about this relationship, does that change your view on what happened or what justice is in this case?
It absolutely does for me. I think that being a person of color and seeing the justice system fail so many people for so long. While I think that he has to serve time and he has to pay for the crimes that he has committed, I think the jury should have gotten a full picture. The influence of someone who has an authoritarian, I don't know what the word is, I guess, that has a power over you. The fact that he was older, the fact that you feel a loyalty to your sibling, to your family, to do what they think is right, that's important. And not only that, there's been questions about the fact that, you know, there was no way that this jury could be unbiased. I mean, the media coverage of this was 24 hours a day. They were just getting fed this information about these two people, didn't know much about them. And how could you possibly make a fair decision after that? So, and then it's a moot point as well. I mean, we can talk about the death penalty later and the fact that Biden's administration has stopped the death penalty. So is it a moot point altogether to even go back and look at this? I don't know. I'm curious what you guys think.
Yeah, you hit on basically everything that I was thinking about this. I mean, I was living around Boston at the time, and it was absolutely like a traumatic event that happened there. You know, I'm not really in favor of the death penalty. I don't think that the government should be in the murder business. You know, at the same time, he was sentenced to death, then that was overturned, and experts are judging that the conservative majority of the Supreme Court is leaning towards reinstating it. But yeah, the whole thing might be moot if Biden is halting all of these executions anyway.
I think it's interesting too. When we're talking about justice, you have to bring up the fact that, you know, how was he being influenced, and how are people influenced to be radicalized, and how does that, how much responsibility do they need to take for the actions they take? You know, at some point you have to say this is a wrong thing, but then you have a family member who's really pressuring you. It was very strange, this idea that there may have been another murder he was involved in. And could he ever have an unbiased jury? I don't know how you could have an unbiased jury in this, really.
We thank you all for being here this week as our panelists. Elizabeth Roman, the reporter for The Republican and Mass Live, and an editor for El Pueblo Latino. Tammy Daniels is the executive editor of iBerkshires.com. And finally, Dave Eisenstater, director, digital editor for public radio station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Thank you for joining us this week on our Week in Review.
And thanks to everyone for listening to And Another Thing This Week from New England Public Media. Remember that you can follow us on social media. We are at AAT on NEPM across all platforms. And you can find our podcasts and past episodes on the And Another Thing page of NEPM.org. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Derek Kennedy. Thanks for joining us.